We are nearing the end of our Bible journey. Not our Bible journey, but we're ending the end of our first part of the Bible journey, which is what we call the Old Testament, it's the story of the Jewish people, the Hebrew nation. It's their story, and we're going to soon have a few weeks of transition before we enter the story of Jesus, entering the holiday season this year, right on time. But as we get through the Old Testament, we're only 6 weeks away from being complete. It's been a year and a half, folks, or more, a year and three quarters almost. And we are about 6 weeks away, counting today, from being finished with our journey through the Old Testament and the Hebrew Scriptures. Their story is almost done. We met a guy last week named Daniel, who's one of the prophets, a book of the prophets. And we saw three stories from the story of Daniel last week that were adventures of his life. We could have done that over 3 weeks. We crammed it into one. And today we're going to spend one more Sunday on the person of Daniel and the book of Daniel. Now, Daniel has 12 chapters. I'm going to throw this on the screen for you here. Daniel has 12 chapters, and there's kind of two sections to these chapters. Daniel chapters 1 through 6 are largely stories or narratives, and Daniel chapters 7 through 12 are largely prophetic, or they're prophecy. And so some people love the prophecy. They love those last chapters. I don't really care to teach much Bible prophecy. I've seen people get so weird with it. I've been in evangelical Christianity my whole life, and I've seen people use prophecy through the filter of their own lens and their own politics and views and get so many things wrong. Even prophecy that's supposed to be fulfilled, what we imagine is not fulfilled yet, and so forth. So anyhow, I don't mess with it much because it just doesn't not a passion point for me after what I've seen done with it historically. But you can go home and read Daniel 7 through 12 for yourself and nerd out to your heart's content. I'd encourage you to do that. But in the first six chapters of Daniel were the story section. And we saw three stories last week, but there are also some prophecies in the first six chapters. However, they're different. The last six chapters are very much like, it reads like the book of Revelation a little bit, quite honestly. The first six chapters are stories, and so the prophecies in the first half are more narrative or story style in their telling. And this series has been more of a storytelling series. So we're going to look at those prophecies today in the first six chapters. I'm going to show you three of them. Just like last week, we could have done 3 weeks today. We're going to do it all in one. So I got a lot of information to dump on you again today. You're welcome. But if you want to read the chapters 7 through 12, you can do that on your own. Let's jump into the three stories today. The three that today will include one prophecy that's going to take place over several hundred years after it happens. Another prophecy will take place a year after it happens. And another one will happen within 24 hours after it's given. So let's look at those three today, beginning in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 1. One night, during the second year of his reign, King Nebuchadnezzar had such disturbing dreams that he could not sleep. Now, I'm going to pause real quick here. For someone who might catch it, it says the second year of his reign. That's not the second year of his reign. It's told from the Jewish perspective. Remember, we met Daniel and his friends last week as teenagers. They were taken in one of the early waves of captivity to Babylon as teenagers to be trained and groomed and prepared to serve in the Babylonian Empire because they were sharp and they stood out. And we saw how that worked out for them, and we saw Daniel's story all the way till he was an old man. But as a teenager, they were brought there and then eventually put into public service. And so this is after Jerusalem completely falls. It's about 12 years into the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, but the second year of his reign over Jerusalem, which is what the author cares about. One night, Nebuchadnezzar had such disturbing dreams that he could not sleep. Have you ever had a disturbing dream, a bad dream that woke you up or kept you awake after you had it? Laura, I know when you were telling me about your dream you had last night, I'm thinking, my sermon today. You can relate to our sermon today because we have two dreams in today's story. That's funny. So if you ever had a disturbing dream, when you're a child, when I was a child, my disturbing dreams usually involved a monster chasing me or Michael Myers or somebody like that. As I've gotten older, they shift more towards usually family-related or important things like the tile floor of my new kitchen or something. I don't know. But anyhow, things shift as you get older. But disturbing dreams are still disturbing dreams. And Nebuchadnezzar has had such a dream, probably shouldn't have eaten such a late meal, or who knows. But he's in a bad mood the next day. He calls all of his astrologers, his magicians, his wise men, everybody in his kingdom who has a position in areas that he's not an expert in. Nebuchadnezzar was an expert in world conquest and domination. Pinky and the Brain style. He wakes up to conquer, to take over the world every day, right? He's going, that's his expertise, right? He is, he's a macro-minded conquering general, whereas he has people who are in the philosophical realm, the spiritual realm. And so he fears they're supposed to know such things as what his weird dream must have meant. But he is probably always cynical like we are. Do they really know how to interpret dreams, or is that just a crock? I don't get that arena, so whatever. But now he needs a dream interpreted. He didn't sleep well. He's in a bad mood. So he calls him and says, I want you to tell me what my dream meant, but I don't know that you really know how. So I'll tell you what, prove yourself by telling me what I dreamed and what it meant, and then I'll know. And if you can't tell me what I dreamed and what it meant, I'll just have you all killed. The end. And they're all like, we can't tell you what you dreamed. Tell us what you dreamed and we'll tell you what it means. In verse number 8, it says, the king replied, I know what you are doing. You are stalling for time because you know that I'm serious when I say, if you don't tell me the dream, you're doomed. So you've conspired to tell me lies, hoping I will change my mind. But tell me the dream, and then I'll know that you can tell me what it means. Tell me the dream, and I'll know you know the meaning. And they're like, listen, they're like, the astrologers, they replied to the king, no one on earth can tell the king his dream, and no king, however great or powerful, has ever asked such a thing of any magician, enchanter, or astrologer. You're being unreasonable. No one can do that. No one's ever been asked to do such an unreasonable request. The king's demand is impossible. No one except the gods can tell you your dream, and they don't live here among the people. And the king was furious when he heard this, and he ordered that all the wise men of Babylon be executed. Unfortunately, verse 13, and because of the king's decree, men were sent to find and kill Daniel and his friends, because apparently when they got pushed into public service, they were part of the wise men leaders category. They were part of the umbrella of his bad mood and butchery that was coming that day. And so when they come to Daniel, the people who are rounding them up feel bad about it, and they tell Daniel why they have to do it. Daniel pleads for them to buy him a little time while he and his friends decide to have some prayer time together to ask God for a miracle. The people rounding them up buy some time for Daniel. He and his friends pray. God shows Daniel the dream and its meaning. Daniel thanks the Lord for the vision and tells about his prayer of thanksgiving. We're skipping all that. But finally, he gets the word to the king that he has an answer. Nebuchadnezzar brings Daniel in and says, I hear that you can tell me my dream and what it means. And Daniel replied in verse 27, there are no wise men, enchanters, magicians, or fortune tellers who can reveal the king's secret. So in other words, your people were right when they were telling you you were asking an unreasonable request. It's true, no one can do that. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the future. Now, I will tell you your dream and the visions you saw as you lay on your bed. And so he says to the king, God can do the impossible, and he stepped in to save some lives, but also to speak into your life. And we're going to see this starting right now. God is working on Nebuchadnezzar, but it's going to be a long path to get him there. He's going to take some weird detours along the way. But God's working on Nebuchadnezzar. So he's going to show him this dream. Now let's read the dream, verse 31. In your vision, your majesty, you saw standing before you a huge shining statue of a man. It was a frightening sight. Can we all agree, if you woke up in the middle of the night or had a dream and there was a big giant statue standing at the foot of your bed, that would be a frightening sight. At least for me, it would be a frightening sight. I don't know how that would be for you. But yeah, that was his nightmare. Now, look at what the details. The statue is made of precious gold, of metals. It says the head of the statue was made of fine gold. Its chest and arms were silver. Its belly and thighs were bronze, and its legs or lower legs were iron, and its feet were a combination of iron and baked clay. Notice the metals get a little less precious all the way down, gold, silver, bronze, iron. Iron's strong, that's good, and then iron mixed with clay. And so there's a whole thing going on here. And then he says, as you watched, a rock was cut from a mountain, but not by human hands. That's important. The rock cut by the mountain is a rock that In other words, the statue would be made by hands. Someone formed the statue and all the parts of the statue. But this rock is not formed by any human hands. It struck the feet of the statue. It struck the feet of iron and clay and smashed them to bits. Of course, that would cause the whole statue to crumble once its feet are smashed. And so, verse 35, the whole statue was crushed into small pieces of iron, clay, bronze, silver, and gold. And of course, they're ground to powder. Then the wind blew them away without a trace, like chaff on a threshing floor. But the rock that knocked the statue down became a great mountain that covered the whole earth. So picture this scenario. The statue, several kinds of metals. Rock comes out of the mountain, crushes the feet. The whole thing collapses. It all gets crushed. And just like Kansas once sang, it became dust in the wind. I'm not sure that's what they meant when they said that, but we'll go with that today. Whereas the rock that crushed it became a great mountain that formed and filled the whole earth. That was his dream. And when he tells Nebuchadnezzar that was your dream, Nebuchadnezzar's like, so as I am. How'd you know that? You must know the meaning of my dream, so go ahead and tell me that as well. So anyhow, he explains the meaning of the dream. I'll give you the brief version on the screen here. As I explain this to you, I want to give one nerd detail to those who care, if you can not be distracted by the screen for a moment while I give you this detail, because I'll walk through that with you. This dream that Nebuchadnezzar has that we're about to see the interpretation of is very similar to that last half of Daniel, chapters 7 through 12, that we're not going to read today. Chapter 7, Daniel has a vision that's more detailed about like four beasts that rise in the earth one after the other. The last one has 10 horns, yada, yada. Anyhow, it's a very similar interpretation to Daniel 7, but with more detail in that chapter than we have in chapter 2. But we're looking at chapter 2. Here's the meaning of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. The head, he says, is the Babylon. These are all kingdoms. These are all empires, starting with the Babylonian Empire, starting with Nebuchadnezzar. Which, by the way, how smart was that? O king, who could have me killed? You are the top dog. You're the first. You're the head of gold. You're the gold standard. You know, your kingdom is right here. After you comes an inferior kingdom someday, represented by the chest and arms of silver. And that will be the Persian Empire that will come after you, or the Medes and the Persians, as some people refer to them. But largely, it was known as the Persian Empire. Following that, the belly and thighs of bronze will represent another kingdom that will rise when a great Macedonian general named Alexander the Great will conquer much of that region and expand the kingdom even further. And the Greek Empire and the Grecian Empire will be powerful. And then when that thing falls apart eventually, the Roman Empire, the Roman Empire and all its might and its legacy will come on the scene. And of course, the feet of iron and clay mixed, people have speculated what does that mean. Some think it's a future prophecies that have not happened yet. Some think there are things in the past. I don't care. We'll figure it out someday. Maybe you do. Send me an email. That's great. But anyhow, he's saying these are the things. By the way, it's interesting. Daniel, in Daniel's visions, he later in his later visions names the Persians and Greek empires by name and saying these guys are coming after us, and they do in fact come to rule the world years and years and decades and centuries later. Now, the rock, what is the rock in the dream? The rock is the kingdom of God. It rolls in, and unlike the statue that was put there by somebody who placed these kingdoms, who allowed these kingdoms to exist, aka God, this rock, who is eternal, or not made with hands, comes rolling in and crushes the statue and breaks it down. What's the rock? The rock is the kingdom of God. The rock is the prophecy of a coming Messiah named Jesus Christ that we're going to meet in a few months here, right? A couple months here. Jesus, who comes in the scene, and he absolutely makes a difference. He forms a powerful movement. As Jesus would say later, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. And Jesus comes along, and he forms this movement, this kingdom on earth, both a kingdom of God, both now in our lives on earth and eternally someday. And of course, all those kingdoms did indeed come to end. They all came to reign, and they all demised. They all disappeared in the pages of history. They all blew away in the wind. All they have now is memories and legacy. But Church of Jesus Christ and the kingdom of God and the movement around the name of Jesus that we just sang about has continued for the last 2,000 years. Here we are across the globe on the other side still singing his name. All over the world today, people praised the name of Jesus in gatherings because it is endured where kingdoms ended. Powerful, beautiful. And that's the first dream. That's the first prophecy we'll see today. And that prophecy took hundreds of years to fully be fulfilled, and maybe arguably some parts may still be lingering. Now, the second prophecy is found in Daniel chapter 4. And I want you to see this because Nebuchadnezzar, God is working on Nebuchadnezzar's heart. In chapter 2, he shows him, you're the head of gold, but it doesn't seem to help because Nebuchadnezzar seems to let it go to his head. He gets all puffed. That's why he makes that giant 90-foot statue that we saw last week that he made people worship or be tossed into the fiery furnace because he got full of himself. But now we see that God is still working on Nebuchadnezzar's heart to bring him, because he was not a believer in Yahweh. He just wanted to believe in himself and the Marduk, the god of the Babylonians, and his own legacy. But God is working on him because God cares about people. God cares not just about the powerful, but also the poor and the needy. But not just the poor, God cares about the powerful and the wealthy. God cares about everyone. And God cares about Nebuchadnezzar, and he's working on his life right now. And so Nebuchadnezzar tells a story in chapter 4, verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar sent this message to the people of every race and nation and language throughout the world. By the way, that's pretty impressive, isn't it? I mean, it's not like they had an email blast. Gmail was not quite invented yet at this point. It wasn't like they could send it over social media. So to send a message to all his empire means he has to write it down. All his people got to make copies upon copies upon copies to take it everywhere. And by the way, translate it, because all the kingdoms they've conquered don't all speak their language. They got to translate it, make multiple copies, send it everywhere. To send a message to your whole kingdom is an ordeal. It must be an important message. Maybe it's about tax increases, right? We're going to raise the taxes, you should know. I don't know. No, that's not what it's about. He says in verse 1, peace and prosperity to you. I want you all to know about the miraculous signs and wonders the Most High God has performed for me. Nebuchadnezzar, the mighty macro-minded conquering general, is going to write to the whole kingdom about the Most High God? What happened to you, buddy? Well, let's find out. Verse 4. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was living in my palace in comfort and prosperity, as much comfort and prosperity as you can have in the ancient world. I mean, anyhow. But what he means is I'm on top of my game. He said, I was ruling everything. At this point, Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom was as advanced and as broad as it has ever been. He is far and wide. He's now trying to keep the kingdom together and maintain what he's built. He always has enemy threats popping up. Kingdoms like the Persians are starting to mobilize, but he can handle that. It's the prime of his reign, and he's living in comfort and prosperity in his palace. But one night, he said, one night I had a dream that frightened me. I saw visions that terrified me as I lay in my bed. And so, of course, Nebuchadnezzar keeps having these dreams and these nightmares. And the first thought should be, I should stop eating tacos late at night. I know that Taco Bell is open till 2 a.m., folks. That does not mean you have to eat tacos at 2 a.m. Nebuchadnezzar or Lighthouse, just take that to heart. Anyhow, but he's having bad dreams, and so he's terrified. He says in verse 6, so I issued an order calling in all the wise men of Babylon so they could tell me what my dream meant. When all the magicians, the enchanters, the astrologers, and fortune tellers came in, I told them the dream, but they could not tell me what it meant. At last, Daniel came in before me, and I told him the dream. Now, I won't read the whole dream to you, but basically, picture this. The dream is one about a giant and beautiful tree, like an epic, the kind of tree that you just love to a picture of or to go visit, like the Disney tree or the tree in the Black Panther movies in Wakanda, just the epic tree that you want to like, whoa, that thing's cool. There's a tree over here in Valparaiso at the Gabus Arboretum that's beautiful. I love to get pictures. It's just a neat, epic tree. You know, if you got a place like that around somewhere, you can look at that and say, this is the kind of tree that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about. He sees this thing. And under this tree, all the animals of the earth gather for shade from the sun or from the elements. They gather to eat the fruit that comes from the tree. Birds build nests in its branches. It's an epic sight. But one day a voice from heaven tells it, that it's lofty and lifted up, and it's going to be cut down. It's going to lose its branches, lose all of its fruit, be scattered, and it's going to be cut down to just a stump. And that stump will just sat there in the middle of the field now. Used to be a tree. Now it just sits there in the field amongst the wild animals, forgotten and existing. Until a period of time passed by where the stump learned that the Most High God rules in the kingdoms of the world, and he puts whom he wants to in charge, whether they are considered worthy or unworthy, powerful or lowly, doesn't matter. God does what he's going to do. And so he tells Daniel the dream, and Daniel shook. In verse 19, it says, upon hearing this, Daniel, who's also known as Belteshazzar, I told you last week that Daniel had a Babylonian name that was given to him. That's the name, but we know him in our reading as Daniel. Daniel was overcome for a time. He was frightened by the meaning of the dream. Then the king said to him, hey, Belteshazzar, don't be alarmed by the dream, about what it means. I'm a big boy, just tell me. Belteshazzar, or Daniel, replied, I wish the events foreshadowed in this dream would happen to your enemies and not to you. In other words, it's going to happen to you, but I wish it wasn't. I wish it was for somebody else and not you, but it's you. And he explains to him that, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the huge tree that's covered so much of the earth, under which people have found their livelihood affected by your being, that you've built through conquest and everything else. But you're convinced, since the head of gold story, and since you built that big idol that people had to worship or die, you've been convinced that you're the man and that you've done all this. And you have gotten to a spot where God feels the need to kind of give you a better perspective and to humble you. And you're going to be cut down. And you're going to lose your kingdom for a while and be like an animal in the field, lose everything until you figure out what God wants you to understand about who you are, who he is, and what your place is in this world in which you run. But he doesn't want this to happen. And so Daniel, because he's worked with the king before, he pleads with him. In verse 27, he says, King Nebuchadnezzar, please accept my advice. Please, I know it's not my job, but please listen to me. What does he say? He says, stop sinning and do what is right. That sounds like a Baptist preacher now. Stop sinning and do what is right. What does that mean? It means whatever I want it to mean, bless God. Whatever I don't like is what I, stop sinning, right? What does that mean? He explains what it means in the next part. He says, break from your wicked past and be merciful to the poor. All these years you have built your empire off of your opportunity, your privilege, your might. You have crushed people. You ran over kingdoms. You have made yourself great on the backs of the people who were in your way. It's a dog-eat-dog survival of the fittest world for you, and you have survived and you have thrived. And now you're in a spot where you're just living the good life, feeling good about it. But stop those ways and start being merciful to the poor. Start being good to the people who are not doing as well as you are because you have it all. Isn't it interesting, folks, at Lighthouse today? Isn't it interesting how much in the scriptures God speaks about how we treat people? I don't just mean in the story of the New Testament or the story of Jesus. That happens there a lot. I mean back in the Old Testament, the old barbaric testament. I'm talking about the brutal Old Testament. In those writings, God over and over again says, treat people right. He'd say, look at me. He'd say, look at me. Honor me first as God, because that will put your life on the right track. Honor me first as God, and then be good to others and treat people right. It's not just a Jesus message, just a God message forever. If you can see it through the noise. Break from your past, be merciful to the poor. Perhaps then, Daniel says, perhaps then you will continue to prosper. Perhaps you can avoid a bad outcome. Well, Nebuchadnezzar, thanks him for coming in. Thanks for coming in, Daniel. That was awesome. I'll take your advice to heart. Don't eat Taco Bell at 2 in the morning, and don't mistreat people. 2 thumbs up. Daniel leaves, and the king, I want to imagine, had maybe a few days or a few weeks of impact by that dream. Perhaps you had a dream that kind of sticks with you for a few days and you can't shake it. Perhaps he turns over a new leaf on some level for a little while. Perhaps for a little while he ends up, trying to do better. Like when we have New Year's resolutions or we get a new gym membership and we do it for a while before we burn out and stop, right? I think for a while maybe he tries to turn it around, but at some point it's back to business as usual for Nebuchadnezzar. Sure enough, verse 28, but all these things did happen to King Nebuchadnezzar. 12 months later, he was taking a walk on the flat roof of the royal palace in Babylon. And there's the problem right there. He had a flat roof on the palace of Babylon. As a man who lives in a building with a lot of flat roof, I'm telling you that God is not in that right there. Those things leak. I'm sure he had a leaky roof. I'm sure he did. But anyhow, he's walking on the roof. As he looked out across the city, he said, "Look at this great city of Babylon. By my own mighty power, I have built this beautiful city as my royal residence to display my majestic splendor." He's like, "I built this. Look at me." The people who I trampled to get it, that's their problem. They shouldn't have been so weak. They shouldn't have been born peasants, you know, that's their problem. But hey, I mean, I've built this. I'm something else. Look at what I've done. I've accomplished so much. I'm the best. And while he's up on the roof, without reading the whole story, at that time he hears a voice from heaven that says, "It's time to learn." And in that moment, Nebuchadnezzar loses his mind. He has a mental breakdown. If you ever had one of those or known someone who did, he has a mental breakdown that's epic. I mean, I don't know if there were people on the roof keeping an eye on him or if they found him later, but he becomes like a crazed animal. I mean, they escort him down. He's probably scared. They get him into the palace. They lock him away to keep him safe from others or from himself. And they try to figure out what's going to happen. Will he come back around? And he doesn't. Days turn into weeks, and they're running the kingdom. They pull the team together and say, "Let's run the kingdom, but tell nobody what's going on with Nebuchadnezzar." You say, why? You say, why? Here's why. Because we all know from history, from Bible history and from world history, that when an epic king in history dies or is assassinated or something happens to them, their kingdom oftentimes goes into decline once they're gone, sometimes rather quickly. So they're hiding him away. They're running a shadow government with him locked away because, you know, he's out of his mind. And they're just figuring things out. And weeks turn into months. How long can we keep this going? Thankfully, there's no social media and videos and people aren't. But how long can we keep this going? We've got to keep the public from knowing that our mighty conquering king is crazy. And during this time, he won't let people near him. His hair grows long. His fingernails grow long like claws. I mean, talons. He's unhelpable. They let him outside and they escort him, funnel him outside for fresh air once in a while. He just digs in the ground, eats the grass. That's crazy. Drools. I mean, they bring him inside. They lock him away. They keep him under lock and key and keep running the kingdom so they don't lose it all. And months turn into who knows how long. It was at least months. Some speculate based upon their interpretation that this went on for years, but at least I would say at least many months, he's out of his mind. His mental breakdown takes full control until one day he finds some healing. It says in verse 34, "After this time had passed, I, Nebuchadnezzar, looked up to heaven. My sanity returned, and I praised and worshiped the Most High and honored the one who lives forever. His rule is everlasting and his kingdom is eternal." Nebuchadnezzar comes to a point where he realizes when he's in the middle of, "I'm the best, I'm the man, I'm unstoppable," that there were people before him who are now gone, and one day he'll be gone, there'll be people after him, and in the meantime, it's all fragile. He's learned that through a very difficult season. And he's like, "I realize there's something bigger and more eternal than all of this. There's a God in heaven who is before and after me, whose rule is everlasting, whose kingdom is eternal. All the people of the earth are nothing compared to him. He does as he pleases among the angels of heaven and among the people of the earth. No one can stop him or say to him, 'What do you mean by doing these things?'" He says, "When my sanity returned to me, so did my honor and glory and kingdom. My advisors and nobles sought me out, and I was restored as the head of my kingdom with even greater honor than before." I find that to be fascinating because I imagine the people who were in the know, it was a little bit embarrassing for him. They kind of saw him during his breakdown. They saw him in his worst moments. Maybe he had moments of lucidity in all of there where he's like, "They saw me. I know what was going on." Or maybe he just looks back and he makes eye contact and thinks, "Yeah, we all know what happened. You kept it on the down low, but we all know." But they honor him. They bring him back. He's like more revered than ever before. Why? How would that happen? Maybe because of the sharp contrast of his greatness to be lost, to come back again was impressive. Maybe he came back better than ever. Maybe they just figured out it's hard to run a kingdom or an empire, and they're glad he's back. I don't know. All of the above. But either way, they're thrilled. No one is the wiser. Let's get back to running this mighty empire. No one needs to know right now, said Shania. But Nebuchadnezzar decides to tell the whole world. And so he writes about it. He sends the word out, everyone to know what happened. Verse 37, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and glorify and honor the King of heaven. All his acts are just and true, and he is able to humble the proud. That God was able to show me something. That I want every subject of my kingdom to understand. I want every ruler who leads like I do in my kingdom to understand that God is able. I can make it all about me, but it was all about him. And really to him, it was all about them. But I thought it was all about me. And God was able to humble me, and God is always able to humble the proud. At some point, we'll all see it. When our life comes to an end or somewhere, we learn it along the way. That there's a bigger picture than just us. And so, he learned a couple of lessons that I want us to point out today before we get to our last story. The first thing that I think Nebuchadnezzar learns in this story is he learns all I have is from him. All I have is from him. At one point, Nebuchadnezzar thinks, I built this. But in the words of a former president, you didn't build this. You didn't. Like the world is my oyster. No, not really. And so he's like, look, Nebuchadnezzar, all you have is from me, God says. And we need to hear that. We need to hear that because it's easy for us to forget that, to think we're self-made people, right? But all of us, the strength we have to do the things we accomplish, where does that strength come from? The mental capacity and fortitude to think and do and operate functionally, who gives us that? We're born into privilege. You say, well, I wasn't born into privilege. Well, in the first place, if we're born in this country, you were globally born into privilege. But even if you're not as privileged as others around you in this great nation, and you overcame it all. You didn't do it by your, God gave you the strength, the mind, the opportunities, the open doors. Everything we have is opportunity from something bigger than us. All I have is from him. That's a great, can we say that together? Ready? All I have is from him. One more time, ready? All I have is from him. It's the second lesson Nebuchadnezzar learned that day. Not all I have is for me. All I have is from him, but not all I have is for me. So some of it is for me to enjoy, but not all. It's not all for my consumption. It's not for me to sit there and say, those people who got in my way, that's their problem, not mine. It's just I'm strong enough to take what I want and do what I want. No. I've been given this opportunity to bless the world with my strength and not crush it. To do for others. To be, as Daniel told him, to be merciful to the poor. Not all I have. All of us today would be better off to realize that all the privilege that we enjoy, not all we have, not all I have is for me. Let's say that together. Ready? Not all I have is for me. One more time. Not all I have is for me. All I have is from him. Not all I have is for me. Nebuchadnezzar learned this lesson, and he wrote about it so the nation knew. One more story. Today, I told you there's a lot to give you. Here goes. Many years later, Daniel 5, verse 1, many years later, King Belshazzar gave a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he drank wine with them. You're like, whoa, rug pull, Belshazzar, where did that come from, Arlen? I thought we're talking about, you know, Nebuchadnezzar the king. This is many years later, Nebuchadnezzar has died, and King Belshazzar is the new reigning king of the Babylonian Empire. Now, I want to undo a couple details that some of you might not even think about, but if you study these things, you might. If you read your Bible, you might get the impression, with just the Bible history in front of you only, that Belshazzar is the son of Nebuchadnezzar. He's his immediate successor, and it's not true. There's actually another king. He is a successor, but he's two kings after Nebuchadnezzar. You have to understand the broader history than just piecing it from just these pages to know that. Also, If you have a King James Version, you might get the impression that Belshazzar is the son of Nebuchadnezzar. Belshazzar is his father, because that's what it says in some of those translations. But that's not true either. He's actually the son of Nabonidus. Let me give you a little history so you'll know what's happening here. In fact, the NLT calls Nebuchadnezzar his predecessor rather than his father or something else. Here's why. When Nebuchadnezzar died, he was succeeded by a man named Nabonidus. You heard it right, Nabonidus. Kind of a cool name like Arlen, right? Nabonidus. And he is the man who takes over the emperor. But as we saw earlier, as I said earlier, kingdoms, when they lose their epic leader, oftentimes go into decline, sometimes quickly, and Babylon began to decline quickly. Other nations began to rebel and find their independence. An empire like the Persians that was growing saw an opportunity to start conquering some of the land that Babylon controlled and eventually move their way to try to take over Babylon itself. And Nabonidus would reign for a while, and then he would die, and his son, Belshazzar, would reign. Now, Nabonidus had a lot of wives and a lot of women who had a lot of kids for him from a lot of different women, like most kings did in those days, including some of the Jewish kings in the Bible. A lot of wives, a lot of women, a lot of kids. And one of his women had a kid named Belshazzar, who was a mighty soldier, a general of the army, and everyone respected him. And so when Nabonidus died, he was the natural, popular heir to the throne. He takes over. Now, here's the connection to Nebuchadnezzar. He's a king in the same kingdom, but also Belshazzar's mom, one of the many women that his father Nebuchadnezzar had, his mom may have been a daughter of a woman who was one of the many women of Nebuchadnezzar, the former king, which could make Belshazzar the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. So it's not way off to say his father or grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar. Anyhow, I just wanted to, who cares, right? Someone cares, so now you know. Belshazzar is the king, and at this point in the story, the city of Babylon is surrounded because the Persians, and along with the Medes, have come together to try to knock off the big boy while their second king has died and they're a little vulnerable. And Belshazzar, the mighty general, is trying to build confidence, but they're surrounded. They're being sieged by the Persians, but they're not afraid. You know why they're not afraid? Because Babylon is the expert at conquering cities. They know how the story goes. And pretty much their city is going to be hard to conquer. It's built to be impenetrable. It is, if you watch Lord of the Rings, the Helm's Deep of cities, right? I mean, no one's going to conquer this baby. They have a river, a large river that runs into the city to keep them nourished. They're going to be fine. But people are nervous because they're not used to being on this end of a military operation. So they're nervous inside the city. So Belshazzar, the new king, the soldier, he throws a party for 1,000 people that says, look, we're going to party and get drunk to say, I ain't scared. Don't you be scared. I ain't scared. Don't you be scared. And to do so, he gathers all the sacred artifacts from all the kingdoms that they've conquered in the past many decades. Artifacts from other nations, including their holy sacred artifacts. For example, the goblets and the cups from the Jewish temple in Jerusalem that they destroyed when they destroyed the temple and the city. They took their sacred furniture from the temple and they brought it to their storehouses. And he brings it out of the treasury and says, we're going to use those sacred objects from those conquered kingdoms to fill them with wine and get drunk as a way of saying, look at all we've accomplished. No one can stand against us. We're the best and we're the baddest. All those gods whose cups we're drinking from, child's play to us. We worship the gods of gold and silver and precious metals because after all, we worship our own opulence. So they throw a party and it's all going fine. Everyone's getting a little comfortable. Until, verse 5, suddenly they saw the fingers of a human hand writing on the plaster wall of the king's palace near the lampstand. Okay, why are all these prophecies of today's story creepy? Bad dreams, nightmares, and now they have some hand over there. They see the lampstand putting light, and over there there's a hand, not a body, just a hand, a strong hand by itself, like a horror movie, writing on the plaster wall and leaving words behind it. It's like carving with his finger words into the plaster wall. And they're like, oh my goodness. One guy's like, oh, I'm a little drunk. I think I see a hand writing into the plaster wall. Isn't that crazy? Dude, I see it too. Oh man. You know, this is not good. So they're freaking out. In fact, it says in the next verse that The king himself saw the hand as it wrote, and his face turned pale with fright. His knees knocked together in fear, and his legs gave way beneath him. Even the brave soldier himself is like, oh, man, that's a little beyond my pay grade. So while he's freaking out, he's trying to figure out what the words mean. He at some point, his mom comes in. She's in the room already, or they bring her in. What's the matter, baby? He's scared. And so she's like, hey, don't worry. There's a man in the kingdom been around a long time. He's an older guy now. He was a teenager when we first met him. His name is Daniel. And he has helped your predecessor, Nebuchadnezzar, have dreams interpreted. He has a special spiritual abilities. Maybe he can help you figure out what those words mean. So they bring Daniel in. And Belshazzar says in verse 16, I'm told that you can give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Make a deal with you, buddy. Make a deal. If you can read these words and tell me their meaning, you'll be clothed in purple robes of honor. How many of you like to have a purple robe? That's your favorite color, Michelle, right? Purple? How many of you love a purple robe of honor? Ooh, that's good, Dolores, right? Purple robe of honor. And you'll have a gold chain. Hold on. You'll have a gold chain. I got one of those right here. You'll have a gold chain placed around your neck. Who wouldn't want that? And you'll become the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Why not second? I don't know, someone had the second already. You'll become third most high ruler in the kingdom. Are you ready? Tell me what the words mean. And Daniel answered in verse 17. Daniel answered the king, keep your gifts or give them to someone else. I'm a minimalist. I don't know. I don't care. Not into the bling. He says, listen, I don't care about your gifts, but I will tell you what the writing means because I'm glad to do that. Before I do, let me tell you a story that you know all too well. Here's the story. Remember your predecessor, Nebuchadnezzar. Remember how that he wrote to all of you about how that he was full of himself on top of his world and God humbled him to teach him that life is more fragile than he thought and that God gives people, whether they're worthy or not, opportunities and that we should give credit to him and use those opportunities to help others. And he learned that lesson and he wrote about it to the whole world. Yeah? He said, let me remind you of that story. Verse 22, you are his successor, O Belshazzar, and you knew all this. Come on now. You knew all this, and yet you have not humbled yourself. For you have proudly defied the Lord of heaven, and you have had these cups from his temple brought before you. You and your nobles and your wives and your concubines have, or your mistresses, have been drinking wine from them while praising the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron and wood and stone. By the way, gods that neither see nor hear nor know anything at all. You've been ignoring the creator of all things and worshiping your own accomplishments, your own opulence and wealth. But you have not honored the God who gives you the breath of life and who controls your destiny. The one who gives us the breath in our lungs. But you've not poured out your praise to him only. And so, he says, I'm going to tell you what those words mean. Now, some speculation from some historians believe that these words on the wall were some kind of a word puzzle that no one could solve, and Daniel moved some vowels or something around and solved them. I don't know. I wasn't there. Maybe some of you were. But he solves the puzzle, and in verse 25, he says, this is the message that was written. Meeni, meeni, tekel, and parson. This is what the words mean. Meeni means numbered. God has numbered the days of your reign and has brought it to an end. By the way, that word meeni was on the wall twice. You know why? Because if you remember anything about prophecy in the Bible, even all the way back 1,500 years, for 1,000 years earlier to Joseph and Pharaoh, that when God gives a statement twice in a vision, it means it's going to happen for sure and it's going to happen soon, right? So meeni twice means your days are numbered and your kingdom's end has arrived now. It's over now. Tekel means weighed, for you have been weighed on the balances and you've not measured up. Parson means divided. Your kingdom has been divided and is given to the Medes and the Persians. There's your answer. What does Belshazzar do? Well, thanks for that cheerful message. But he keeps his word. He's going to honor Daniel. So it says then, at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was dressed in purple robes. Here's your robe. Thanks, you know, put the robe on him. And a gold chain was hung around his neck. There you go. By the way, it's not my chain, by the way. I got this from Anthony's personal wardrobe. He lent it to me today for the sake of it all. Not really. Here's your gold chain. And he was proclaimed the third highest ruler of the kingdom. And he's like, I don't want to be third highest ruler in the kingdom because it's about to end. And so guess who's going to go down with the ship? The people in charge. No, thank you. You can take your stuff. I'm just going to put this away, send it to Goodwill. Someone else can wear it. Well, guess what was happening while they're having this party? I told you that the Persians were seizing the city, trying to conquer the city. They weren't scared. They're powerful. But what they didn't know is while the Persians and the Medes were out there trying to conquer the city, they figured something out. They had a plan. They had engineers come in, and they put a plan together. But they had to pull it off just the perfect way. So here's what they did. They had to wait to try to, they realized that river that ran into the city was insurmountable. But if they could find a way to dam up the river a little bit to stop the flow of water and give them an access point. Now you can't, that takes a long time. They'll see what you're doing. They'll start a battle. It's a dangerous move. But they found a way to do it quickly enough to where under the cover of dark, the water flow slows down. No one can see that. And they can, at nighttime, quickly get into the trench where the water used to be. The water still is, but they can get in the water and survive and manage to get under the city, walk them to the other side. Kill the people who were guarding the entrances, open the gates of the city, and let the soldiers on in. And sure enough, that very night, Belshazzar, the Babylonian king, was killed. And Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. And there it is. Three prophecies of Daniel, not in the later chapters, the boring prophecies that some of you would love, but I don't. But in the first, the story chapters, three prophecies of Daniel, one that was fulfilled over the next several hundred years, one that was fulfilled a year after it happened, and one that happened that very night. And that's it. We'll wrap up in a moment here, but let me say after today, we have five more messages to go, and we'll be finishing with the Old Testament and getting into some new territory together. But for today, what do we learn? Well, what did Belshazzar not learn? He Daniel says, you knew what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. You knew all this, but you never learned. You know why? Because those who refuse to learn from the past are what? I'm doomed to repeat it. That's not just true for Belshazzar. That's true for me and you. That when we refuse to learn from the past, whether it's biblical ancient past or historical past or our own past or the past we see around us, those who refuse to learn from the past are indeed doomed to repeat it. So what can we learn from the past? What can we learn from today's story that helps us? Well, let's learn what Nebuchadnezzar tried to pass along after he learned his thing. What can we take home with us today? Simply this, that all I have is from him, not all I have is for me. Today, we are all privileged and blessed to some level. Maybe not compared to somebody else if we want to do that, but we're all blessed. And maybe we want more. Maybe we're striving for more. Maybe we're tempted to have a dog-eat-dog survival of the fittest mindset to the world. But here's the deal. Whatever we have and will have and have had is because God has allowed us to. All I have is from him. But not all I have is for me. It's for me, yes, but it's also for God to bless others. Too, because God cares about me and you. God cares about me and others. God cares about you and others. God cares about you and your family. You and your spouse. You and your kids. You and your family. You and your relatives. You and your neighborhood, you and the poor in your community, you and the world in which you live. All I have is from him, not all I have is from me. When we can have that approach about our possessions, about our accomplishments, and have that open-handedness about what we think it's for, we're better people for it, and we'll make the world a better place because of it. So let's say those words together. Ready? All I have is from him, not all I have is for me. So, I want to give you a simple little prayer today to take home with you that I think this little prayer, short, like two short sentences is all it is. I want you to write it down or take a picture of the screen or take a screenshot if you're watching online. Thanks for joining us today. Write this down, take a picture. I want you to use this, maybe every day, maybe several times a day, maybe once a week or once a month, I don't care. Do it often enough that it helps remind us of this big idea, this macro picture that will keep us grounded. This simple prayer I want to give you will help guard your heart. It goes like this. Thank you, Lord. Thank you for what I have. What do you want me to do with it? Lord, thank you for what I have. What do you want me to do with it? That's a simple prayer. It's a prayer we all should pray because it both reminds us who blesses us and it reminds us of our responsibility in the world and the life with which God gives us. And saying that prayer can give us some refocus, some recentering when we tend to drift off one way or another. So I hope you'll take that prayer to heart. Would you say it with me right now? Ready? Thank you for what I have. What do you want me to do with it? One more time. Thank you for what I have. What do you want me to do with it? That's a great prayer.